Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 94, otherwise known as season 5, episode 16. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How you doing, Jacob?
Doing okay, just trying to stay cool with the heat wave going on.
It is still hot. We're recording super early today, and it's already like 90 degrees. What the hell is this?
Yeah, my brain is fried. I could barely sleep last night.
Oh, also with us, as always, is your other host, John Correa. And I'm sure he has something to say about the heat.
Yeah. We were saying how I was in sticky man mode like 4 episodes ago.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, never came out of it. And what's even worse is the show I'm working on right now. I don't know if I've said it on the podcast. I'm working on Quantum Leap, the reboot, but we're doing a Western episode this week. We're doing a Western episode during a fucking heat wave. So, you know, doing great sitting in a tent for fucking 8 hours a day.
Sticky man never ends.
I was sure you'd have something to say about the heat because you're the one of us that actually works outside on their day job.
Which is insane because I'm an ad man. But whatever. But no, it's not too bad. We actually have a decent spot where there's like some tree shade, and we finally got some AC units for our tent, so it's manageable.
Now, the real question is, working on a Western episode, how realistic is the horse training from Nope?
It's I haven't witnessed that aspect of it yet, but it is honestly, Nope has been in the back of my mind all week because we are shooting on the Universal backlot, and we are shooting in the Western town, so it is really fucking cool, and like the amount of work that the props and set deck team have put in it, because I've worked in the Western town before, but it was always like turning like the saloon set into like an interview room or like something else. I've never worked in Western town, they call that part of the Universal lot, when it's an actual Western. So it's really cool seeing something where it's like always been kind of a shell of it be fully used to its full thing. It's like, holy shit, yeah, no, I could see why this is used so much in films, because it looks great. Oh, I can't wait. Quantum Leap premieres September 16th on NBC, Peacock, and all that stuff.
So what have you guys been watching this week? There's not a lot has come out since last time we talked.
Yeah, not a lot of new stuff has come out, but an old classic got a brand new re-release. And I'm talking about Steven Spielberg's Jaws, which got an IMAX and 3D release. And I saw it in IMAX at the AMC Universal a couple days ago.
And
I was skeptical, but I went to the IMAX version, so it wasn't in 3D, but it was blown up and had the video and audio transferred to IMAX levels, and it was pretty awesome. Like, you know, just seeing Jaws on the biggest screen possible with the highest film and audio quality possible just almost made it feel like watching it for the first time.
I could see like it being blown up for IMAX working really well, especially if you're working off of like, you know, original negatives with the transfer and restoration. The 3D I'm a bit interested in, because that was my senior thesis for critical studies, was re-releasing films in 3D and the different techniques used for it. Granted, that was, God, 10 years ago now? Fuck me, I'm old.
We're all old.
Yeah, we're getting old. So I'm a little interested in like what they did in their process, and also why, because that's not really a thing anymore. Like, no one's really releasing things in 3D or doing really any 3D. And I'm also kind of scared. Is this going to be the start of the next big 3D swing? Because that was exhausting.
It's one thing if a movie was shot in 3D, like say the Final Destination movies, or, you know, something that they knew was 3D from the beginning. Something like Jaws, which is a 50-year-old movie, or what, 47 years old, and they're just going to convert it to 3D. That's why I'm kind of skeptical about it. But from what I've heard, the 3D is actually done pretty well. I mean, I haven't seen it, but
it all depends on the techniques used. Because I know, like, when they re-released, because I part of my thesis is I saw Top Gun and Jurassic Park re-released in IMAX 3D. And like the Top Gun one was done really well, where they messed with the like depths, and they did like what they called 3D scoring. And like, so certain scenes weren't in 3D, like Goose's funeral wasn't, out of respect to the character, which I thought was silly. But like it added the depths to it, which is still a weird concept, because we already perceive film in a three-dimensional plane because of how it's shot and our minds and stuff. So it's weird having to put on the glasses for it. But the Jurassic Park one was terrible. At certain parts, it looked like, because they cut out elements using digital, so it's suddenly like bushes that aren't CG looked like CG. And like sometimes the 3D just looked like a cheap diorama that some kid made for his classroom, you know, with like cardboard cutouts and stuff. It was very weird. So, I mean, granted, again, that was like 12 years ago, so, 12 years ago or so.
I always loved those movies, like in the wave of 3D that came in the early 80s, like, you know, Jaws 3D and Friday the 13th part, basically any part three was in 3D, Amityville 3D. And they made you absolutely sure that you knew that they were in 3D. So when you watch them, so like if you're watching on TV not in 3D, all of a sudden they stick like a pole in your face. Yeah.
it always reminds me in the heyday of TGIF television when they would do like the 3D night of 3D episodes, and there was like one where it was America's Funniest Home Video and Bob Saget's just dangling his car keys in front of the camera. He's like, look how 3D it is. And that was their contribution to it. Like whenever that happens in those movies where like, what was it? Friday 13th 3D when they fired the harpoon. Like it just reminds me of Bob Saget dangling his keys in my face. So like
eye popping 3D, literally.
I saw this movie called The Movie, which let me tell you, I had to do a written review of it as well. Mm. And trying to find any information about a movie called The Movie is the most annoying thing in the world. Even trying to find it on IMDb, you type in The Movie and you get Superman The Movie, Paw Patrol The Movie, Jackass The Movie. You're like, no, this is called The Movie. Anyway, it's about this quote washed up, because she's not really washed up, but she's like an aging actress who gets a delivery, and the delivery guy is actually this crazy dude who has a movie pitch for her. So he's like, oh, I recognize you. He's all, you should be in my movie. And he basically smooth talks his way into her house and wants to make his movie that night with her. It's like a home invasion kind of a thing. And it turns into kind of a torture movie. But the problem is there's only really one scene of torture. It's like they blew their effects budget on one scene, and then the rest of it is just like making the viewer feel uncomfortable, and not in like a Megan is Missing way, in kind of like a, you know, how can we make the viewer more uncomfortable in this? Let's rape her, this woman. You know, how can we make it more uncomfortable? Let's have him take a shit with her in the room. You know, it's just stuff like that. So it's kind of, I mean, it's a good idea. It's just, I don't think it's executed as well as it should be. And they didn't go far enough. They either should have toned it back and had it focus more on the psychological things, or gone full bore Hostile and had him, you know, just brutalize this woman. And yeah, anyway, it's called The Movie. And if you can find it,
I was about to say, good luck finding it, I guess.
It's coming on VOD, I guess. It'll, by the time this airs, it'll be on VOD. So, you know, if you see it, if you stumble across it somewhere, if you hunt it down, it might be a little difficult to find because it's freaking called The Movie. But anyway.
Well, I've been continuing my deep dives into franchises I haven't done deep dives into before. So previously it was the Chucky series, which was a lot of fun. And where I watched from Bride through season one of Chucky. And this weekend, I'm in the middle of tackling Children of the Corn, which
only to Hellraiser in why the hell did they make this sequel?
Oh, to keep the copyright.
Keep the copyright.
Same reason, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I in watching two and three, there was definitely like in the back of my mind, I'm going, tell me you were trying to hold on to the copyrights without telling me you were trying to hold on to the copyrights, which is, I'm so glad that Dimension/Miramax made 8 sequels to Children of the Corn to hold on to the rights, because it was so worth it for them to finally make a Children of the Corn prequel that they only showed for 2 nights in a theater in Florida 2 years ago. Like, good job, guys. You held on to the rights for 30 fucking years to do that. I gotta say, like, yeah, it's been a fun. I got the Arrow trilogy set, which came with like the 4K restoration of the original, which looks phenomenal. It's if you say what you will, but the sequels, that is a gorgeous box set, loaded with features.
And the original Children of the Corn is really good.
it still holds up, but it's not the original. And that's the fun thing about the box set too, is it also has the short film Disciples of the Crow.
Oh, I love that. It was the original Dollar Baby before they made a movie of it.
It was the first adaptation that came out a year prior. It is worse than either of the first two. Disciples of the Crow. It's 18 minutes long, so it's like super duper condensed. But man, dude, like it is funny because it hits all the familiar notes. But there's some like really rough dialogue, and but yeah, Disciples of the Crow is still a fun artifact to watch. You know, it's very low budget regional. It is still incredible to see how easy it was to find a deserted town like that to shoot in, especially early 80s. But not much has changed with that. You still drive across America and there's still like those like ghost towns in these areas. But yeah, no, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm going to be watching 4 through 6 today. One of the noteworthy things about that series is how many big name actors got their starts in those movies. I mean, Charlize Theron was an extra in Children of the Corn 3 Urban Harvest, which I had so much fun with that one. That one went for it hard, which is funny because like only the first two got theatrical distribution and the third one was straight to video. And yet the third one looked like it had much more of a budget than the second one.
Yeah. And also the third one had the special effects by Screaming Mad George. So yeah. It looked really good.
Yeah, it did. Oh, man. When He Who Walks Behind the Rose comes out as like the giant monster at the end.
Yeah, the husk flesh beast thing. Yeah, that was crazy.
That was so ridiculous.
That one was also probably the goriest in the franchise just because I feel like they had Screaming Mad George. It's like, okay, let's just put as much body horror and blood and guts and crazy shit.
There was some really cool stuff with like the corn husks, like going into people's bodies and like eye gouging and like stitching people's eyes. The movie opens with like someone getting their body like ripped, their
and turned ripped into off. A scarecrow.
Yeah, there's some like really cool stuff in there. It's still a very silly movie, but
oh yeah,
I had a lot of fun with that one. And it's also funny because came out in 95, which was the same year as Dangerous Minds. And both of those movies have very similar themes of just like a white person coming into, an urban area and trying to instill, their ideology without, really understanding what urban life is like. Dangerous Minds and Children of the Corn 3, pretty much the same movie.
When we used to tour every summer in my band, this was like the mid 90s. There are patches of the country, and you might have to be driving through on like a Sunday morning or something, but parts of like Nebraska, Oklahoma, Iowa, you're driving through and the only thing you can find on the radio is like church preaching.
Oh, 1000%.
And it would always just crack us up. We're like, are we going into like Children of the Corn right now?
There's a horror movie right there with you guys going on tour and going to the cursed town.
It's Green Room. Yeah. Green Room meets Children of the Corn. We're on to something.
Well, and that's the thing too, is that like I did my cross country tripping in the 2010s. And it's the same thing where there's large stretches of road where all you have is that fire and brimstone preaching radios and those hundreds of miles of just like all those billboards and stuff. And like I think that's one of the reasons why the original at least Children of the Corn is not only is it a really good American folk horror film, but it's also just like it's still there. Like you still encounter those towns, you still encounter a lot of what they talked about, like I was very taken back with how much of the dialogue is still relevant with like the main guy was saying, things to the kids, just because are you so diluted from the preaching, those fire and brimstone preachers that you'll just believe anything from them? Or like it's not an actual religion if it doesn't include compassion and love for others. There was a lot of really good stuff about some of the more hate mongering aspects of some religions, and it was real good. And Linda Hamilton is fucking awesome. I can't stress how great that Arrow Blu-ray is. They have a phenomenal interview with her and where she talks about like how doing that film, because it was so early in her career too, really got her to fall in love with like the more physical aspects of doing like horror and action and comedy. And it was really cool. And Linda Hamilton is just one of the ultimates. You know?
So without Children of the Corn, we may not have had a Terminator.
And without Terminator, we wouldn't have Terminator 2.
What a world it could have been.
Oh, I don't want to live in that timeline.
Yeah, that is the darkest timeline.
Going back to our last episode where we were talking about people, you know, with like Fall and Open Water 2, people in dumb situations that they put themselves in. I saw a movie this week. I think it's from last year. It's not that old, called 12 Feet Deep. Are you guys familiar with this at all?
No.
It is. It's about these two girls. I'm laughing just talking about the concept. They get stuck in a community pool when the cover is closed for the Thanksgiving weekend.
Is there water in it?
Yeah. They're swimming in it. And I mean, and it explains why it happened. And actually the guy who traps them in it inadvertently, it's an accident, but it's Tobin Bell.
Of course it is.
Yeah. Totally in one of those, you know, Kane Hodder taking every party's offered type of a thing. But yeah, they're swimming in this pool and the cover gets closed and they get stuck in there, and there are air pockets. The cover is about a foot above the water so they can breathe. But then there's another cleaning lady who knows that they're in there and decides to use it to her advantage. So, you know, there's more to it than just having to wait out the weekend. But it's just, it's one of those kind of like what I was saying about Open Water too, where they jump off the boat and forget to put a ladder down. You know, it's one of those, it's like, or even Frozen, where, you know, they turn off the ski lift and go home, you know, for the week. You know, it's one of those, how the hell can this happen? They kind of make it logical how it happened, but it's just one of those movies you're like, this is just silly. You
know? As for me, I've been going a lot to the New Beverly recently, because you know how Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery started their own podcast, The Video Archive?
Yeah, I've been seeing the hot takes from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've been programming around it is the thing. So like a lot, if they discuss movies, they've been making some double features around it. And a lot of them have been genre, which is pretty cool. Like the one I was most excited for was they did a double feature of Michael Mann's The Key and Peter Hyams' The Relic.
Ooh.
Yeah, no, and the prints were amazing, and you know, I'm just such a huge fan of Michael Mann's The Keep, even though Quentin Tarantino isn't, that I went to that double feature twice that weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, and they also did Demonoid and The Brood a couple days ago, so that was a pretty wild double bill too.
Oh, damn. That's awesome. I need to get out to the New Bev more.
Oh, yeah. No, dude, it is worth it, especially to see like kind of the more obscure and rare stuff on 35 millimeter. They also had a crazy ass Shaolin Kung Fu double feature with this one movie called The Shaolin Invincibles, where I swear to God, the main villain, the evil emperor, has gorilla bodyguards that know Kung Fu.
Gorillas? Like actual like primate gorillas or gorilla with a G-U?
Gorillas as in ape gorillas.
Okay.
Although it was clearly just dudes in costumes, but still Kung Fu gorillas.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong with Kung Fu gorillas.
Yeah, no. That's just the kind of cinema I love. Just crazy. I had no idea this existed, but I'm glad I was able to watch it.
Today, we're joined by a couple of special guests. They're the screenwriters of the new film, The Retaliators. So let's welcome the Gear Brothers, Darren and Jeff. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Excellent, man.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being here. The question I always like to start off is, how did you guys get started in filmmaking? How did you guys know that you wanted to be writers?
Oh, boy.
And that's the response I usually get, too.
Oh, boy.
I think there's a long story, probably. There's a short story.
Yeah.
The short story is Darren came to me and said, hey, you want to write movies with me? And I was like, yeah, let's do it. That was about 4 years ago.
Yeah. We're brothers, obviously. We grew up with just a really obsessive love for cinema, genre cinema. And I mean, we just watched so many endless movies growing up, and then into, you know, just always, we just always have just been just huge passion for digging into, you know, the catalogs of different actors and directors and subgenres and just all kinds of stuff. And I had my early, when I was young, I had a little bit of an acting career. A career would be a stretch of a word on it, but I worked a little bit. I studied acting for a good amount of time. And so I definitely had a little bit of a taste and a little bit of experience in the entertainment world via that, but never as a writer. And then kind of got into music. And Jeff and I played in a band, and we put, you know, a couple records out, and this was sort of the early 2000s. We were young and playing and doing all that. And it just, you know, all through all of that, we had just always sort of kind of fantasized about, it'd be, you know, we would come up with movie ideas and, you know, again, just sort of being a natural extension from, you know, just being such lifelong fans of film. And so, yeah, when it finally materialized, it really did feel like this crazy, like, hey, do you want to just try it? You want to just do it? And so it really was, little did we know how much we, well, first of all, how much we just would love it too. You know, we just right away, just, you know, we dug into the craft and sort of put ourselves through our own kind of education formally outside of what we had already, you know, sort of lived and reading hundreds and hundreds of scripts over the years was an enormous part of my education too.
Yeah. It was, it's kind of funny when I think about it, because me and Darren, we definitely made like movies when we were kids. You know, Darren, you were almost older than me. So I was the little brother kind of hanging around. And, you know, we do, you know, camcorder movies and stuff like that.
Little shorts, ridiculous things.
And it is sort of strange now being a screenwriter, because I think for many years, I wasn't in the film industry at all. I was always doing other things, but all the while I was always like the biggest, you know, film buff of every group of people I would come around, you know. So I studied philosophy and like everybody in like philosophy programs and stuff, nobody knew shit about movies, you know what I mean? And it always kind of surprised me, like, God, man, no one's like into movies like I'm into movies. And took a while, but I kind of found I should just do movies.
What kind of movies did you guys watch when you were growing up? I mean, what were your influences, I guess I should say?
Yeah, growing up, we were really big fans of, a lot of 70s and 80s, the classic action genre films and horror genre films. But one of our mutual passions that we connected on early and stayed a lifelong passion was our love for all things B cinema and exploitation films. And, as much as we can sit and talk, you know, William Friedkin for, you know, 2 hours, we can spend just, you know, the same amount of time, digging into the Canon Films catalog, which we love and watch to this day. So,
how you guys came from different backgrounds into this. You were saying that Darren, you had more of an acting career, but Jeff, you were kind of more outside of the entertainment world. What was that like coming together as screenwriters? I know you guys were saying that you were huge fans of exploitation and your film Retaliators kind of kept a lot of that spirit going there. You know, there's a lot of influence of like, you know, Death Wish and things of that, but you guys really hammered in on the moral debates of vengeance. You know, there's a coming from a place of healing and whether losing yourself into that really is healing. What were some of the influences and, you know, kind of debates that you guys had with that?
Well, yeah, what you know, because the film was inspired by real events that happened in our family, the idea of of a sort of revenge fantasy was sort of born organically through, kind of being on the sidelines during a long trial. And so we certainly were sort of, looking that was on our mind, and that definitely sort of, came out in the idea for the Retaliators originally. Because of our love of genre cinema, we wanted the film to ultimately be fun and be, be something that, wasn't taking itself too seriously. We wanted to play with the moral dilemma, but also not telegraph any sort of message to the audience. It was important for us that we weren't, we really tried to be kind of show, these different characters that made different choices sort of through an empathetic lens both ways. And really, our fantasy we would always talk about is we wanted to have a movie where people could argue after the film and debate, what was the right thing to do or not.
Yeah. I think, me and Darren, we did not treat our writing sessions as like a philosophy seminar room. We weren't trying, we were really just interested in, we never really had a discussion, I think, on who's right, who's wrong, or anything like that. It was really just where the fun for us was looking at these characters and what are they going to do when they're faced with the dilemmas they find themselves in, and what choices do they make, and what are the consequences of those choices? And it was made much more with the intention of having people, the moviegoers walking out of the theater kind of arguing with each other, going like, who was right, who was wrong, what would you do, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because there was definitely a juggling with all of that. I mean, just the basic premise of the preacher giving an opportunity to get revenge on the killer of his daughter, and the cop who sets it up, and has clearly been doing it for some time for himself. Yeah, yeah, and yeah. Others, there's definitely a lot to explore there. And I did appreciate how there was no, you definitely see the both sides of things with it, without kind of getting too preachy, but you see the consequences of both. You guys do a great job of just like, I think Jay was saying it before when we were discussing the film yesterday, really flipping it, like you think it's going one way, and then all of a sudden the film kind of turns into another.
We always say that when we're talking about movies, we're like, oh, this becomes a completely different movie. And usually that would only happen maybe once. In The Retaliators, it happens like four times. So it's like you think you're watching one thing. I mean, and it actually happens from the first scene, which is the big teaser. And then after that, you're like, okay, no, that's not the movie we're watching. It's really full of surprises.
Oh, that's really cool to hear, because, Jeff and I always talk, we call it the hard turn. We're really big fans of hard turns in films. The earliest example, I guess, kind of proto example would be like Psycho, right? It's obviously you're following a protagonist, and then very famously, you then switch protagonists and you switch genres, you switch tone, you switch everything at sort of not quite the midpoint of the film. And in horror, Audition's a great example. Hostel's a great example.
From Dusk Till Dawn is the
Dusk
example.
Dawn. Yeah. And
even,
so
even Hannibal, Cannibal Holocaust, with the intro.
Yeah. Yeah. There's
where you end up in that film.
Yeah. So, we definitely, that was something we people were scared of that, there were people, even some people making the film because the easier choice would be to establish, a kind of a familiar genre feel and then just sort of live in that. And we very much wanted it to be like, you know, oh, I think I've seen this movie before, and then completely subvert that and try to, like, you know, use the word surprise. That was the whole goal. You know, how can we just create this kind of winding roller coaster? So the scariest part truly was executing it. Can we execute it? Can we get away with it? Can it work? I mean, we were literally, when we debuted at the first festival, which was Fright Fest in London, I mean, we couldn't sleep the night before because we were just going, gosh, is anyone going to, you know, is this ride going to make sense? Or is this just too, because the ones, you know, we just really believed in that vision. It's, you know, so did Michael Lombardi.
You ever want to make like a roller coaster? You're the only person who likes to ride it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's pretty, exactly. Pretty lonely coaster. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And on the, development and production sides of things, how did the project get started? Like, how did you pitch it? How did it get off the ground?
Well, it was such a crazy thing. You know, we had sent the film, the script to the Blacklist to get coverage. And we were very humbly, we had very humble expectations. I mean, we were like, okay, we're going to learn everything we're doing wrong, and then we'll work on that. And the next thing you know, we got these high ratings and we got on their top list. And we were, I mean, that was the shock started then and went all the way till now, you know, where we're just going, wow, this is crazy. And then we started getting people reaching out and producers and different people wanting to option the film. And the real serendipity at the beginning was I happened to know Michael Lombardi, who obviously, you know, starred in the film and was the main producer, and he even directed a good amount of the film as well. He was the guy. It was a complete coincidence as we were driving to a meeting with some people who wanted to option the film. He called me out of the blue. We had worked together years back. And he called me completely out of the blue. I had told him what we were doing, and he said, send me the script immediately. And we did. And he lives on the East Coast, and he was on a plane in 3 days. And he said, he called us the next day, said, do not option this to anybody. Don't do anything. I'm getting on a plane. And we were like, really? And he's like, yeah. And he flew out and he just said, you know, I am number one, born to play this role. And Jeff said, right when he got, you know, right when we saw him, he just went, oh shit, we're looking at John Bishop. He was, you know, and he was being funny, but he was serious. Like, he was just right there, right when we saw him. And he said, I'll get this movie made, and I will, you know, run through hell to get this made. I'll make it happen. And he had some ideas, and it was crazy. We just sort of right at the beginning just knew we had to partner with Michael, and we did. And we just said, okay, let's go on this journey together. And boy, the amount of times Jeff and I have looked at each other and said, the smartest thing we ever did was that, because Michael took it and got it funded, and he was the reason we ended up getting the bands that we got in the film. And he fought through all of the COVID, because there was so much drama with getting our film made because of the fact that we were literally a couple weeks into shooting in the third week of March of 2020.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, we were our SAG rep told us, we were shooting in the forests of New Jersey at the time, and the SAG rep told us we were officially, as we were getting shut down, that we were officially the last union production in the world. at that moment. And we, you know, obviously we had to shut down, and then the obstacles of shooting through the early days of the pandemic, because that's what we were, that's what we were left with. And so this was when COVID tests were thousands of dollars, and we had to switch coasts, and we had to change directors, and we had to, we had cast drop out, cast come back in. We had to obviously monitor safety, and thank God no one became, we had very few people that ultimately got sick, and nobody was, had, we didn't have any bad situations with people getting sick, thank God. But Michael was the guy that ran quarterback through all of that, executing and making it happen. And it was unbelievable. I mean, it was just nothing would stop him or us. And just and thankfully, with the backing we had through Alan Kovac, same thing. You know, he just was so determined. Okay, what guys, what haven't we gotten? What do we still need? And we were like, well, we still don't have this, or weren't able to get this, because, you know, we'd been shut down multiple times. We'd had, you know, back again, those early days were absolutely insane. Just the amount of work it took just to deal with the logistics, you know, because this was all SAG. This was all, you know, this was all above the board. You know, we weren't doing anything guerrilla. You know, this was all, you know, 100%, you know, with safety being in mind, 100% in mind, and with the rules being in mind. So it was playing it by those rules and doing it was really, really difficult, because you could see from the film, there's lots of locations, there's lots of casts, you know, there's a lot going on.
Now, you kind of piqued our interest with talking about the actual events, and you mentioned a trial. And I mean, we don't want to pry into anything that you don't want to say, but can you tell us a little bit about the inspiration for the story? Like what it, I mean, it actually did happen to a family member of yours, or something inspired it, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And I'll address why, you know, we're very comfortable being able to talk about this and share this story. But there was a real life tragedy that happened, and trauma in our family, which was that our younger sister, some years back when she was still a teenager, she was 19 at the time. She was walking home. I mean, just straight out of a horror movie. She was walking home from a party, like around the corner from her house at the time. And this was in Northern California. And she was walking home really late. She thought she heard a jogger running behind her and turned around and was tackled. And literally tackled down a 20-something foot ravine. She was brutally attacked, raped, and really almost killed. She had a belt around her neck, and she was within inches of her life, of losing her life. She miraculously fought and clawed and escaped the situation. Ran up the ravine, no clothes on, waved down traffic, and was thankfully, you know, got away. Well, that, the perpetrator, was not caught. And so there was years of her dealing with her PTSD, and just obviously that was all very rough for her. And she, you know, fought hard to sort of overcome all of those things. Well, years later, through the advancements of DNA, they find the guy, and he was a serial rapist. He was posing as a taxi driver in the same area years and years later, was caught trying to do this to someone else. So God knows how many people he hit along the way. You know, I mean, it's horrifying to think about, but they caught him. And then a trial ensued, and The trial was, you know, like any trial, it was a long process. It was a very rough process. There were multiple versions of the trial, and, you know, you have the typical ups and downs that go with the trial. And so, you know, it was during the trial phase where the thought just popped into my head one night, where it was like, what if there was a underground service that you know, provided family members of crime victims with revenge. And I sort of jotted down a quick little idea, and then I just wrote The Retaliators. And it was just in a list of ideas, you know, Jeff and I, we had decided we were going to write, and we were just sort of coming up with ideas left and right. Like we always do. We always just kind of stack ideas and log lines. And one day Jeff was just going through, we were like, okay, what are we going to do? And he found that one. And we basically, first thing we did was went to our sister and basically said, hey, you know, because what was sort of ironic was right near that time, she had reached out to me and said, you know, do you know anyone? She said, listen, I really want my story to get out, because the happy ending for her was that not only did she get past all that PTSD, but she went on to have and still has a very successful career as a firefighter, and she's one of the few female fire captains in the United States today. And so she really wanted her story out. She wanted to be an inspiration to people who've suffered crippling PTSD and been through very serious trauma, and being the survivor that she was. She had reached out and asked me, do I know anybody in the documentary space? And I had looked, I had kind of put some feelers out, and I couldn't really find anything, find a way to sort of facilitate that. And then all of a sudden the script idea comes up. So we sat her down and just said, you know, how would you feel if, you know, we wrote a script that was sort of used your story as kind of a springboard? And we told her directly, it's like, look, we can't tell your exact story. You know, there's no way we could live in that in a script for years. And at that time, we had no, you know, the reality of it being made into a film seemed so distant. But we just, it was just the writing. We were just like, we want to be able to sort of enjoy the process. So the only way to do that is to sort of, and we wouldn't be good documentarians of that story anyway. We're too close to it. And she was like, oh, absolutely. And she said, listen, please just use my name. She's like, if you ever have the opportunity to, please use my name. So her name is Jodi Geer, and her story, you can Google her, and you can, you know, they did some news pieces on her, and the trial was documented. So we're very proud to tell the story and use her name, because ultimately there's a lot of happy endings here. Yeah, the guy's put away pretty much for life. He'll be a very old man when he comes up for parole, and hopefully he won't get out. So there's a happy ending there. As I said, Jodi's life has, you know, she's gone on to be very successful and just an amazing human. And then the catharsis of making this script and taking something so ugly and horrible, but yet finding a positive outlet for it that's been truly, ironically, talk about healing, the film has been very healing for the family, and for us and for Jodi. So it's good. We didn't have to go and torture anybody to find that healing. So,
well,
it's good.
You didn't. it's all there.
Yeah, right.
I'm just kidding.
Much better to put it in writing than to actually, yeah, you know,
yes,
go through with it.
To be clear, I agree with that.
Yeah, and that's one of the most interesting aspects of this film, because like you guys said, you're coming from a place of love for you know, exploitation and, you know, canon films and these very like, you know, rough movies where they're talking about doing these very sadistic things or getting vengeance and whatnot. And it's coming from a place of catharsisism because, you know, you're exploring these dark themes, but going through it with the lens of a love for cult cinema, you know, and, right. And yeah. And especially, you know, those type of films don't always get the best light. You know, a lot of people, you know, when you're talking about these type of films, most people are like, they're so exploitive. And it's like, well, it's in the name. So it is interesting that it is coming from a place of catharsisism, a place of hope and a place of, you know, healing, especially for your family. So you feel it a bit in the movie and that's just so great to hear that you're using your platforms to tell this story. And you're right. Sometimes it's you kind of have to put these things through lens. That's why genres exist. It's easier to discuss heavy issues when it's through the lens of like sci-fi or horror, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And we appreciate so much hearing that. We appreciate that just we've gotten so much great feedback with that sort of risky thing we tried, because again, it was just, there was a lot of doubt of can we pull this off and does this make sense? And the way you just put it right now, it makes so much sense to us. It's just, we love genre films. We take genre film very seriously and we don't look down on it. At all. We can laugh at it. We can laugh at the, you know, the right. absurdity, certainly like just like anybody else, but we have a real genuine love and appreciation for it. So yeah, for us, we were just like, well, look, we don't want to do, we don't want to do trauma porn. You know, it's like, you know, cause there are some movies like that. And if that's somebody's taste, great, you know, no knocking it at all. But for us, like it's just movies that are sort of dirges that are just, you know, and our movies gets pretty bleak and it's pretty dark. But it was so important for us to, in that third act, like, you know, really have a catharsis, have an experience of release. We tortured every sort of hero and anti-hero in the film. And it was sort of like, we got to have some, let's bring in the fun and that spirit big time in that third act.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and to kind of second that a little bit in a different way, you know, there are really heavy movies that deal with these themes that, you know, they're excellent movies. I mean, they're some of the best cinema ever created, but a lot of times you can only watch those movies once, you know, they're too heavy. To watch repeatedly. And, you know, what I think we really shot for with this movie and writing it and then executing it, filming it and stuff, mm-hmm. was trying to make a movie that deals with these themes, but is very watchable and rewatchable. You know what I mean? Because of how fun it is. So.
Yep. Okay, great. Well, we are running out of time, so we'll leave it at that. Everybody go see The Retaliators. It should, by the time this posts, I believe it comes out the next day on VOD. Is it the 14th?
No. So we're The Retaliators is in theaters on the 14th, and we've gotten, our tickets went on pre-sale a few weeks ago, and the pre-sale's been going so well that we keep getting extensions on days and screening time. So in some areas, we're now up to 10 days in theaters. So no, we're not on VOD then. We don't have a date yet on when we're going to VOD. I think it'll be sometime in October. So yeah, we're in theaters starting on September 14th.
Yeah, I saw a preview at the Lemley when I went to go see 3,000 Years of Longing for So it's definitely playing in the
LA area. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Nice. I've been hearing about it playing. I know we were playing before Nope in some places, and I've seen, we've been hearing that. So it's great. And what's really exciting too, is that we are worldwide. We're in 41 countries on, I think it's close to like 1500 screens. So it's really, really exciting. And our pre-sale is going well, even in other countries too. So we've been getting little reports and stuff. So yeah, it's really exciting.
All right, congratulations.
Yeah, congrats, guys.
Thank you.
Awesome. And what's next? Do you guys have something that you can bring up real quick that's coming over, or is it a bit hush?
We have a rom-com in the works.
Yes. Okay. Think Nora Ephron, but then we go full exploitation. No. Actually, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
I think we'll have that to, one on the yeah, back, we'll yeah. put that one on the back. We've got, we are really excited. And so we took advantage of the insanity times of the pandemic to basically go, because the film kept, we kept starting it back up and having to shut down and kind of over and over again. It was this kind of long saga. So we really hunkered down every chance we could to really, work on new scripts and we've been working hard doing that and polishing those. And so we are really excited. We've got a few. We've got one that is sort of a creature feature that is sort of told from the creature's perspective, but it also blends with a crime thriller, and it almost has a Coen Brothers sort of, like if Coen Brothers did a creature feature, was sort of our goal with that one.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of like No Country for Old Men meets Hogzilla.
Yes. So yeah, that's a good way to put it. But it's actually got, it's quite a bit lighter in tone. There's a lot more humor in it. It's a lot of, there's some great gore stuff that we've concocted. We're excited about. But yeah, it's a good amount of humor in it. And then we've got another one that we're just finishing right now, but that one's, we'll keep it just that one kind of under wraps, but it's sort of a little bit of inspiration. We're big
Magic Mike fans.
Yeah so we kind of go no it's we gotta,
yeah, you're speaking Korea's language now.
No joke, Magic Mike XXL is one of my favorite movies, so.
Hey man, that's
hey, cool.
he's not joking, we're all laughing, but he's dead serious.
Yeah,
I love it, dude.
That's well, listen, up before
the last thing the last thing you will ever catch us doing is shaming anybody for a movie taste, because we have just so many endless, like, we don't even really use the word guilty pleasure, but
I don't like to say that. Yeah, because I'll love movies that are supposed to be so bad they're good so much that I'll go, they're not bad anymore. Bad.
Unironically love Cats.
Yeah.
And that's what people make fun of me for.
Well, listen, we very much loved Cats, but I think with the big irony, but I think the irony was attached.
Wait, wasn't there some talk about the like the butthole cut?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, when are we getting that? That's what I'm waiting for. No.
Well, yes. Yeah.
No, I 100% agree with you guys. I hate the term guilty pleasure.
I
think anyone should feel guilty about something that gives them pleasure is if it hurts another person. That's it.
Art is subjective. People can like what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't feel guilty about liking anything I like.
Yeah. Unless you're punching down. Yeah. Don't feel guilty about what you love.
Yeah. All right. Cool. We are going to get out of here. So thank you guys very much for joining us. The Gear Brothers, go see Retaliators. It will be in theaters and then on VOD this October. So go check it out. So thanks for joining us today, guys. Our theme song is by Restless Spirit, so go check them out. Our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so go check him out. You can find us at Eye on Horror on any of the socials or at iHorror.com. Where can people find you guys, Jeff and Darren?
Yeah, you can go. The two important spots would be retaliatorsmovie.com. That will any theater near you will geo pop up as soon as you go to that. And then as far as finding the Gear Brothers, you can find us on Instagram at the_gear_brothers. Just look up the Gear Brothers and we'll pop up. And you can find us on there.
Okay, cool. Well, great. Thanks for spending your early Sunday with us. And we all look forward to whatever you guys have coming next.
Awesome. Thanks.
Awesome.
We will see you listeners in a couple of weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
And we're the Gear Brothers.
Keep your eye on horror.